This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss your skincare inside and out with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We'll find out about the health benefits of dance with dance teacher and author, Teacher Terrell. We'll learn about trauma recovery with therapist and brain health coach, Kristen Rivas. And lastly, we'll discover how to help someone suffering with an epileptic seizure with Dr. Julia Jacobs. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Everyone knows that fiber is healthy and an important part of our daily diet. Fiber is cellulose, the stringy stuff that plants are made of. Dietary fiber comes from vegetables or whole grain products. Fiber helps keep our gut microbiome healthy and balanced. It serves as the starting point of a natural food chain. It begins with bacteria that can digest cellulose, providing the rest of our microbiome with a balanced diet. But our eating habits in an industrial society are far removed from those of ancient humans. This is impacting our intestinal flora, it seems, as newly discovered cellulose-degrading bacteria are being lost from the human gut microbiome, especially in industrialized societies, according to a new report published in Science. The research team behind that report identified important new members of the human gut microbiome, cellulose-degrading bacteria named Ruminococcus. These bacteria degrade cellulose by producing large and highly specialized extracellular protein complexes called cellulosomes. Cellulosomes are engineered by bacteria to attach to cellulose fibers and peel them apart, like the individual threads in a piece of rope. The cellulosomal enzymes then break down the individual threads of the fiber into shorter chains, which become soluble. They can be digested not only by the ruminococcus, but also by many other members of the gut microbiome. The production of the cellulosomes put ruminococcus at the top of the fiber-degrading cascade that feeds a healthy gut microbiome. However, the story does not end there. Sampling of human cohorts revealed that ruminococcus strains are indeed robust components of the human gut microbiome among human hunter-gatherer societies and among rural human societies, but that they are sparse or missing in human samples from industrialized societies. Diet is changing in industrialized societies far removed from the farms where food is produced. The authors of the study conclude that this shift away from fiber-rich diet is an explanation for the loss of important cellulose-degrading microbes in our microbiome. How can you counteract this evolutionary decline? It might help to do what doctors and dietitians have been saying for decades: eat more fiber. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwick in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Attention men over 50. Do you search for restrooms everywhere you go? Wake up several times at night just to go pee again? Are symptoms of a benign enlarged prostate taking over? Prostate Perform helps reduce the urgency and frequency of pesky pit stops in as little as 7 to 10 days. Available exclusively through natural health food stores. To ensure these products are right for you, always follow label directions. Dr. Colleen Hartwick is a licensed naturopathic physician who's been in private practice since 2012 in Campbell River, BC. Dr. Hartwick has a special interest in trauma as it pertains to physical illness, and as such, her practice focuses on mental health. In addition, she's passionate about sharing her knowledge and has been a part-time instructor at the Canadian School for Nutrition since 2015 and recently began publishing educational articles with Naturopathic Currents. Today, we're going to do a deep dive into the world of skincare, which is an interesting metaphor there, because usually skin is not very deep, but we'll see what we can do. Covering both internal and external approaches to achieve that radiant glow just in time for the return of sun and heat. Welcome back to the show, Colleen. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me back. I'm always happy to chat with you.
Yeah, same. All right, so skincare. Can you share some key nutrients and supplements vital for healthy skin? We're going to go right to the nutrients today.
Yeah, we'll start deep and kind of move to the surface, as it were.
Yeah.
So the list is long in terms of nutrients you could consider for skin health. So I'll just go over some key ones. Especially nutrients that I find patients of mine might be lacking in their diet. So first category would be those ever-important omega fatty acids, so the omega-3s, the omega-6s, and one in particular, it's called GLA, really important for skin health. And another category of omega fatty acid called omega-7, not everyone's familiar with that one, so I'll kind of touch on each one in terms of what their health effects are. And then move on to a couple of other key nutrients that, again, your listeners might want to focus on either on the supplement front or the whole foods front. So the omega-3s, most people know, they're anti-inflammatory. And with a lot of inflammation, especially on the skin, that could be associated with disruptions of the skin barrier, more skin dryness, itchiness, accelerated aging as well. With those omega-6s, and one in particular called GLA, and the omega-7s, also really important for skin barrier function, so to help keep our skin young, youthful, well hydrated as well. Both of those fatty acids, the omega-6 and omega-7, also act as antioxidants, and oxidative stress or free radicals are associated with breakdown of the skin, of the important skin proteins like collagen and elastin. So the more oxidative stress we have, more likely we are to see thinning skin and unsightly wrinkles. So those omega fatty acids, super important for skin. Beyond that, nutrients like vitamin C is super key for skin health, actually within the skin and the outer layer, the epidermis, typically really abundant with vitamin C, and that's kind of by design. Vitamin C is there to help with producing collagen, which again helps skin look young and plump and youthful. Vitamin C is also there to help protect the skin from photo damage, from the damage caused by exposure to sunlight. So with that, again, vitamin C can help to maintain healthy, youthful skin. And then the last couple of nutrients really important for skin health, minerals like zinc and selenium. Both are antioxidant, help to prevent, similar to vitamin C, sun damage to the skin. And then lastly, a B vitamin called biotin. People who are biotin deficient more likely to have thin skin, dry skin, just generally unhealthy looking skin.
Okay. So for those who are inclined to get those nutrients through their diet, are we capable of doing that? And if so, what sort of foods should we be focusing on?
Yeah, absolutely. So for focusing on that first category of nutrients, so the fatty acids, I find most of my patients are especially not getting enough of the omega-3 fatty acids. Actually, Stats Canada a couple of years ago released a report stipulating that about 40% of Canadians are not getting enough omega-3s in their diet. And that's typically because, and I see this with my patients as well, they're not eating a lot of fish, and fish is one of the richest sources of those omega-3 fatty acids. So whether we're focused on omega-3s, omega-6s, or the omega-7s that I mentioned as being important nutrients for the skin, foods like salmon, anchovies, nuts and seeds like walnuts and macadamia nuts and flax seeds and sea buckthorn berries, all very rich in omega-3s, omega-6s, and with the sea buckthorn, they're one of the richest sources of omega-7. So those are some food options, but oftentimes I find myself recommending supplementation for patients as well.
Okay. So beyond diet, what tips do you have for nurturing healthy skin from within?
Yeah, absolutely. So a key property to the skin is helping to keep it moisturized. And again, those dietary fats are really important for that function. But as well, so is drinking enough fluid, staying hydrated. People who are underhydrated are way more prone to have dry-looking skin that lacks sort of plumpness, so staying hydrated. And that typically looks like drinking about 2.5 liters of fluid a day, usually water, but again, anything that's just not caffeinated or a diuretic would count. Eating a balanced diet with lots of brightly colored fruits and vegetables, because with those bright colors, that shows us, that tells us, those bright pigments tell us that those foods are rich in various different vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants. And again, I mentioned that oxidative stress or free radical damage is really harmful to the skin. It's associated with accelerated skin aging, loss of elasticity, greater wrinkle formation, and incorporating foods rich in those omega-3s, omega-6s, and omega-7s. So whether you're opting for some cold water fish, more nuts and seeds, things like sea buckthorn berries. And again, if you don't see yourself incorporating those foods in your diet directly, then look at supplementation as a good alternative.
Okay, so let's shift gears a bit. We talked about internal skincare. Let's shift to external. What are some of the natural ingredients that can be beneficial for skin health that we can use topically, let's say to faces and bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. So something to know about skin, and especially the skin on our complexion, so face, is that it has a more acidic pH. And so when you're putting substances on your skin, want to choose ingredients that are going to support that optimal pH. It's usually somewhere around like 4.5 to 5.5. And for your audience, if they're not familiar with the pH scale, that's on the acidic side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So ingredients like vitamin C, that has a low pH, so it's acidic. Hyaluronic acid, also acidic. Collagen and retinol, which is like a vitamin A derivative, all of them have varying degrees of acidic pH, as well as a host of other beneficial effects on the skin. So vitamin C, we've talked about it internally, but as well topically, we can get some added boosting in collagen production that helps skin maintain hydration, look plumper, fuller, and more youthful. Hyaluronic acid also has a hydrating quality to it. It helps to plump up the skin, decrease wrinkle formation, and even the appearance of wrinkles that are already formed. Retinol, again, that vitamin A derivative, helps stimulate cell turnover so that we have newer, younger-looking skin cells. As an antioxidant, also helps to protect the skin from the damage caused by things like sun exposure. And as I mentioned, again, those ingredients all have more of an acidic pH, and so that helps to maintain the integrity of the skin barrier and helps to support the microbiome that we have on the skin.
I presume skin protection is relevant too, right? Like, you know, not a lot of exposure to the sun would be helpful, I would think. Am I right?
You're totally on the nose there, pun intended. Yeah. The nose is on the face. But yeah, I've mentioned a couple times that sun damage is associated with accelerated aging, so thinning skin, more wrinkle formation. So being conscientious around sun exposure and limiting sun exposure. While we know sun exposure is important for things like vitamin D production, you know, more is not always better. So whether that looks like wearing a hat, longer sleeves, sunscreen, absolutely those kind of sun protective practices can help to protect the skin, keeping it looking young and healthy.
Okay. Let's talk about being realistic. So like I'm in my 50s and, you know, men have a little bit easier than women when it comes to like the wrinkles in skin, or at least appears that way. But even as like all of us are getting older, and at some point you realize, you know, your skin isn't going to look the way it did when you're in your teens and 20s. So when we're talking about skincare, I presume there's only so much we can do, right? Like we shouldn't have expectations that we're going to be forever young, right?
No, I think I think that's so important to touch on, to again set realistic expectations for yourself. I'm almost 40 and I've definitely noticed a few more laugh lines and some frowny lines. I do also spend a lot of time outside, and at least for me, I see my wrinkles in part as like the story of my life, where I spend a lot of time laughing and enjoying my life. But we also don't have to resign ourselves to a more accelerated rate of skin aging. So to do what we can to preserve skin health, but also accept that skin aging is just a part of the aging process itself. And And yeah, you're right. Men had a little bit of an easier time, I think, on the whole, navigating that that aging process. You also have the luxury of being able to maybe hide some wrinkles in the form of growing facial hair, where us women don't have that same luxury.
We were talking before about supplements and things that we can purchase. How can our listeners discern what are the best options in terms of the products that they're looking for skincare?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, probably your best bet would be to consult someone with some expert knowledge on skin and skin health. So, you know, a naturopathic doctor who's got a special interest in skin. There's lots of colleagues of mine who focus on skincare, or an esthetician. If that's not feasible for you, and you're just at the health food store looking for good options, make sure that whatever products you're purchasing have been third-party tested and have an ISO accreditation. The ISO, I believe it's 17025 labs, are sort of the gold standard in terms of coming in, testing products for purity, make sure there's no contaminants in there, as well as making sure that what is on the label in terms of the ingredients and the dosage is actually what's present within the product. So looking for that ISO accreditation lets you know that this product is forthright with what's inside the bottle.
Yep. And a moment ago, you were talking about a skincare protocol. So how can our listeners sort of maintain consistency in that protocol? Because, you know, we have so many things that we need to do. As I get older, there's like so many things I need to do. So how do I keep it up? What do I do?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, for those people who are health-minded, health is a commitment, right? There's typically a lot of steps involved. And so we want to keep it, you know, as simple as possible, but as effective as possible. And so for me, that looked like a little bit of trial and error in terms of finding the right brand for my particular skin. And I keep it pretty simple. So I cleanse my skin. I usually apply a toner. Most toners are more on the acid side of the spectrum. And again, maintaining that acid pH of the skin, super important. And I usually finish it off with some version of a serum, which is like a mixture of different fats. I forgot to mention that. But fats, and these are fats from various oils like avocado oil or rosa moscata oil, or jojoba oil. They actually feed the bacteria on your skin. Like, we have a microbiome in our gut, we have a microbiome on our skin, and those skin bacteria, the beneficial ones that help our skin stay moist and hydrated and protected from other types of bacteria that might be associated with rashes and stuff like that, they like to feed on fat. So picking an oil-based moisturizer or serum that your skin really likes. And again, to be consistent, so, and pick a plan in terms of cleansing, moisturization, that's one in the budget for you and something that you're willing to do twice a day.
Fantastic advice. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll talk about the health benefits of dance on The Tonic.
At Pure Encapsulations, good starts with uncompromising standards. This is why we avoid additives such as magnesium stearate. Although we know it could speed up production time, we also know it doesn't add any health benefits. Instead, time is our additive. To maintain the integrity of the premium ingredients that do benefit your health. But our commitment to wellness doesn't end there. It extends to our planet as well. Through our sustainability initiatives, we are making strides toward a healthier future.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.ca.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Teacher Terrell, with decades of experience teaching creative movement and ballet, was honored by her local city council in 2014 for her dedication to children in the community. Trained by Ballet Met and the Louisville Ballet, she shifted her focus to toddler and preschool curricula after witnessing her own daughter's love for dance, completing a certification program with King County Arts Commission. Beyond her dance expertise, she served as a program for early parent support board member and Bellevue College's family advocate, studying child development in graduate school and teaching English and dance in Namibia as a Peace Corps volunteer. With a rich background spanning from student to teacher to parent, she embodies a lifelong commitment to the art of dance. Welcome to the show, Terrell. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about the health benefits of dance. Does that sound like a plan to you?
It sounds great. Okay. I have a lot to say about that.
Oh, I hope so, because we've got some time to fill. So what are the mental health benefits of dance, do you think?
So I think a lot of people are struggling post-COVID to just get off the couch. And I know I'm struggling with that. My family is too. And we know that exercise is so good for us, and so is social connection. But the thing about dance is that it's a low-stakes social interaction. So you're going and you're connecting with people and you're sharing space and you're taking turns, but there's no awkward small talk. So it's just a really fun, easy way to go and get that exercise. And when you feel those endorphins and you can get in the habit, and you know, dance is hard, so there's a lot of success when you actually achieve, you know, the fancy ballerina pirouette, or you remember a chunk of hip-hop choreography. There's really a sense of accomplishment because it is so progressive but yet not competitive, and so it's just this beautiful gift that we can give ourselves.
Okay, so I have to make an admission. Part of the reason why I wanted to bring you on the show is because my wife advised me that she would like to take dancing lessons with her. And there are many things I'm very good at, but I have to tell you, dance and movement is really not one of them. It's funny, I used to DJ when I was younger, so I love music and I can sing, but I just can't dance. So I'm hoping you can convince me to follow through on my promise to her that I'm actually going to get up and go dancing. So, all right?
Yeah, for sure. And you can, you know, there's so many different kinds of dance. Dance is in our DNA. It goes back like 9,000 years. We know the first little cave drawings of dancers.
Yeah.
So it's in there, and you can find whatever speaks to you, whether that's hip hop or ballet or social dance, or even just, you know, going out like clubbing. And people, I love, because I have taught a long time, and I've taught beginners. I taught a lot of beginners, and I love that people can come in wherever they are, at whatever level they are, and really, you know, move forward from there. So whether, you know, you did ballet when you were younger and you're coming in with a base of experience, you know, you just progress from there, or whether, like, you come in, as so many of my students did over the years, not able to even identify, you know, in ballet you turn out, so your toes go to the side and your heels come in, and so people would not actually, you know, be able to figure out even how to stand that way. And then over time, you know, so wherever you are, there's progress, and there are dance classes kind of at every level. And I think it's kind of the adult ballet world is really blossoming, so there are a lot of different opportunities for even beginners to start.
Okay.
Well, not that you have to do ballet.
Well, I hope so. I was going to say, you know, you said it's in everybody's DNA, but I might be a mutant, and it may not actually be in my DNA. We'll find out.
Do you enjoy music?
I do.
So what music do you like most?
It's pretty eclectic, I would say. It depends on my mood, actually, truthfully. I'm not sure what she means. I'm not sure if we're doing hip hop or I'm not sure if we're doing the tango. I honestly, I'm more afraid of what she thinks this is going to be than what I contemplate it's going to be.
Yeah, maybe you guys should do something together, like a social, you know, like a more ballroom.
I hope that's what she means. Actually, I think I'd feel the most comfortable with that, strangely.
Yeah.
The thought of doing hip hop really terrifies me. And I think it would probably be, anybody that knows me would probably think it's hilarious and hope that it would be video taped. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. We don't want people to step like way outside their comfort zone, just a little bit. So definitely whatever is resonating with you, I would say start there.
Okay.
And, you know, and give it a try. And do go more than once, because the first time is going to suck, right?
Yeah.
Like I said, you're going to be standing with your toes going the wrong way, or, you know, or you're going to step on our toes. Like, it's just a given. So just accept that and laugh at it. And then I would say just please, please commit to three lessons, because okay. That's when you really start to see some, you know, the repetition and the patterning take hold.
You started with two and now we're up to three. All right. So you say that dance has some benefits as opposed to like sports or other types of exercise. Do you want to elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah. So dance has so much more movement. So the variety of movement is much broader. If you think about like swimming or rowing, like those are great exercises, but dance has like so much, even like Pilates and yoga, you know, which are kind of dance adjacent. Like there's just such a wider breadth of movement. And then dance is so body and brain connected, and there's music layered on that. And, you know, so we're learning stability, we're learning coordination, like new neural pathways at every age are being formed, spatial awareness, you're less likely to fall and injure yourself. So, like, if you can stand, I was reading a study last night that if you can't balance on one leg and hold it for 10 seconds, you're twice as likely to die in the next decade. And your risk of dementia goes down. So it's just, like, I know we're limited on our time, but I could be here all day talking about the great things about dance.
You know, the one leg thing. So I've been practicing brushing my teeth on one leg because I wanted to make sure I could do 10 seconds. I'm well above 10 seconds, but it actually is a very good indicator because there's so many slip and falls. And then once people who are older slip and fall and perhaps hurt their hips, it could be a very downward trend. So
I actually have... Our next book that comes out is literally called Falling into Dance, and it's all about falling and falling safely and some play on words with falling and choreography and things like that. But it is about, like, you know, you will be less injured when you are older. So if you practice falling and think about it and just dance in general.
I'm a big advocate in getting in front of issues like mobility. Like, mobility is such a key for people, particularly in North America, because we're so beholden to our vehicles. But at some point, you stop driving or it becomes impossible to drive where you want to be. So being able to be mobile, I think, is crucial to everybody's aging process. And I presume you agree, and dance plays a part in that.
I really agree, and I had a lot of really sweet, mostly ladies, but a couple men, come in and learn ballet in their 70s, and I had, a lot of people told me, like, oh, this is so great for my mobility, and one woman was unable to turn her head at all, and the doctors told her that she never would, and she credited, you know, ballet with a little bit of mobility there. So yes, definitely. And you know, it's all, like I was saying before, it's degrees of improvement. And so, you know, maybe you won't get full mobility, but you will get some improvement, and it's really great for everything.
We've talked about the physicality of dance, but you think there are other benefits as well. What about the social benefits and educational benefits? Do you want to elaborate on that?
So for social, the group I was just talking about, they're still together. I'm going to meet them at a park next week. So they really bonded over ballet, and they always embraced anyone that came in. You know, I hear about the woman that moved to Canada, and I get updates from them about her and her, you know, her young kids. And so they really took this to the max, where they have their whole, like, social network that was really based on my dance class. They call themselves the Pink Tights Gang, and it's just a really lovely story in itself. But, yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, and another thing we talk about that I love is that we're all this one big dancing world. So I really feel like I could go to any city, anywhere, and find a dance class and kind of find my tribe and make a connection. And that is just such a beautiful thing to hold on to, you know, that if I'm ever in a new place, I have that option. So dance socially. So educationally, we know that, and I look at a lot of studies, and I have for many years, and it's just incredible to me. I don't understand, like, why we're not all dancing all the time. For school students, we know at every age that they are more engaged, that they have better grades, that they have better attendance, that they are less likely to be depressed, less likely to be suicidal. Like, it's just so good, and it's almost immediate, the impact. So studies, people have gone in and done studies with, like, different age groups, like middle schoolers. If you go in and you add a class, like, 3 weeks later, like, there's already an impact. And it's, you know, it's data-driven, and it's imperial, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And we should just all be dancing all the time.
Yeah, my understanding is, even later in life, the type of movement like dance, as opposed to doing a static exercise, although exercise can help with this too, but it actually helps with cognition. Were you aware of that?
Definitely. You're learning stronger memory. You're learning stronger listening. You're getting comprehension, better sequencing. You're more creative. You're problem solving better. Just like everything. So there's a lot of learning as well. And you are making new neural pathways all the time. You're coordinating body and breath. You're coordinating body and mind. You're also coordinating that music. So it's like four-dimensional learning and brain, like, supercharged, like, yes. And yes, they are seeing that dance is better than any other form of exercise. And they're doing studies on that, and they're, you know, they're looking at it. And, it's just incredible to just look at all of this stuff and wonder why we're all not doing it.
Exactly. Well, I think you may have convinced me. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
That was Teacher Terrell. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. Tired of lineups at your pharmacist? Why not try Pharma-Z at the Zoomer Store? Powered by the Health Depot, an Ontario-accredited pharmacy, Pharma-Z offers a concierge approach to filling, refilling, and managing your prescriptions with free delivery anywhere in Ontario. To get started, visit zoomerstore.com and click on Pharma-Z. And then click on the Circle of Care Pharmacy program for your free initial consultation with a clinical pharmacist. Don't wait. Go today.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Kristen Rivas, a certified RRT therapist and brain health coach, pioneers recovery for trauma survivors with over a decade of private practice experience. Her holistic approach fosters resilience and growth, neutralizing the fight or flight response for improved mental clarity and well-being. As a TEDx speaker and former radio host, Kristen also educates mental health professionals and medical practitioners, drawing inspiration from her degree in missions and psychology from Southeastern University. Welcome to the show, Kristen. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about trauma therapy. Can you tell us what RRT, or Rapid Resolution Trauma Therapy, is?
Sure. Rapid resolution therapy, it uses innovative concepts and methods to transform how different facets of a client's mind is processing information that has been basically causing problems for that person. That information could be the data you and I would call memory. It could be imagination. It could be automatic meanings, thoughts, opinions, judgments that are getting generated from a subconscious level for a person, and response to stuff in their environment, certain kinds of stimulus. And an RRT facilitator takes it upon themselves, like it's their responsibility, to as efficiently and painlessly as possible use things like multi-level communication techniques that could mean metaphors, storytelling, some conversational hypnotherapy kinds of stuff. Maybe you've heard of neuro-linguistic programming. We use some tools like that to affect their mind's way of looking at things and responding and reacting to things. So that means a client can come in at the beginning of a session saying that they have a problematic pattern of behavior, like maybe a bad habit, perhaps they've been having nightmares or panic attacks, and that they have been struggling with a troubling emotion like anger, resentment, fear, guilt, shame, jealousy, grief, envy, something like that. And the rapid resolution therapy facilitator will take it upon themselves to now cause that client's mind to think, feel, and respond differently to things so that that person notices a shift to where they're automatically thinking and feeling and reacting differently by the time that session has been completed, or maybe by at the end of a few follow-up sessions. So we aim to get a shift for the person that they're not having to try to remember to think a certain way or to do certain things. We're trying to cause them to have an automatically different way of processing things at a subconscious level.
Hmm. Okay. It sounds very involved. What's,
yeah.
What's your personal experience with RRT? How long have you been doing it, and how does it work, et cetera, et cetera?
I had a 2-hour and 20-minute long session with the founder of Rapid Resolution Therapy. His name is Dr. John Connolly, back on June 20th of 2009. And it was the most interesting, uplifting, and life-changing conversation that I've ever had. I gave a TEDx talk about it in 2013 that's called The Life-Changing Power of Words, Kristen Rivas at TEDx Rainier. And I'll say that from the start of that session, it was different than any other therapy that I'd had. I had been to 6 other therapists, but when I walked into Dr. Connolly's office, the first thing that he asked me was, what would you like to get done today? And I had never had anybody imply that we could actually get stuff done, especially in like a single day. And so that was different off the bat. He explained to me some of the differences about how our minds are built to work in comparison to the minds of animals and what causes problems for us humans that lead to things like PTSD and what we could do to adjust how my mind was working. He was very entertaining. He was interesting. It was mainly done in a really uplifting and lighthearted way that kept me engaged, made the process feel light. Other times, other therapies I had done were painful and felt like really heavy and arduous. And he took really good care of me. And I actually laughed throughout most of the session, which was something I for sure hadn't expected.
So how's RRT different from the other types of therapy when dealing with PTSD, for example?
So RRT is different in a couple of ways. Most traditional mental health industry approaches are either going about trauma at an angle of like delving deep into what's disturbing to try to get a cathartic release to happen, or maybe some kind of greater empathy and acceptance of one's issues. That process can be prolonged and emotionally really taxing. And there are other folks, like there are other approaches that involve more cognitive strategies to try to induce a desired change by like trying to argue with one's own thoughts and over time challenge them enough and retrain the mind enough from that person remembering to, hey, if that thought comes up, purposefully think this way now. Write it down in a journal. Every time you have a triggering thought, write a new thought down. Again, that process can be long and difficult for people. And both of the processes risk dismissing an individual's feelings as illogical and can cause that person frustration. And when those traditional therapies fall short, a lot of times the practitioners attribute it to their patient being like resistant or lacking enough motivation. And that can further complicate the therapeutic relationship and effectiveness. Rapid resolution therapy, like I said, is, we say that it's the practitioner, the facilitator's responsibility to have caused such a connection, to have been so convincing, so influential, so impactful at causing a new positive transformational experience that we have rewired somebody's neural pathways and retrained their nervous system for them within usually 1 to 4 sessions to get a shift for that person in their patterns of thoughts, in their patterns of reactions and behaviors. So we, again, have training to do this in a way that we are causing it to be as of an uplifting experience as possible and really painless and efficient to the best of our ability.
Is it for everybody? Does everybody respond the same way?
Of course, people are different and there are different things going on with people. So some things to watch out for when heading into any kind of therapeutic process. People would it's good to know that certain mental health issues can be caused by issues going on with somebody's brain health or their hormonal health or their digestive health. So if somebody's issues are not specifically a result of trauma, and they might be dealing with a traumatic brain injury that's been unaddressed, improperly treated, they might be dealing with food allergies, vitamin nutritional deficiencies, hormonal imbalances, like it would be useful to get those things checked out by a doctor and be getting those things treated with like dietary changes, lifestyle changes, stuff like with exercise. And then RRT could be an adjunct therapy because it works best when we are rewiring neural pathways that have to do as a result of especially like single incident trauma. The more somebody experienced a history of complex trauma where there were things that happened in a very like ongoing way, many different kinds of traumas, that's when we might have to be like more patient with more sessions and a more informed rapid resolution therapy specialist to adequately serve the person. But when we're treating something holistically for somebody that has multiple different kinds of issues going on that are causing mental health symptoms, like changes in mood, sleep, and stuff like that, we definitely know that RRT can help improve somebody's health by the things that we do to clear trauma or the use of like hypnotherapy tools to help improve somebody's health, even their digestive health. So it's not like a deal breaker. It's just things that you might want to use more adjunct therapies, and you might want to have a bit more patience with the process.
Okay, we have time for one last question, and that is, does RRT lend itself to sort of other types of trauma therapies, or does it need to be used independently?
So other types of trauma therapies, like perhaps EMDR or interfamily systems therapy or CBT, maybe biocognitive therapy, neurofeedback, or brain spotting. There's also something called sensory motor psychotherapy. Those kinds of therapies might be useful to get somebody into helping to manage their symptoms and not be as afraid of if symptoms arise. Because when doing trauma clearing processes, there can be a thing known as ab reaction, where a memory can come up and somebody can very quickly automatically experience that memory as like as if it were currently happening or as if it's just about to happen or it just happened, and there can be a strong emotional reaction. So other therapies might help stabilize somebody and get them to be not as afraid of their symptoms coming up, but RRT works really, really great at resolving the underlying reasons of why the symptoms are getting generated and preventing them from being a pattern for people.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain that.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kristen Rivas. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to help someone who's having an epileptic seizure on the tonic. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to local, organic, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since 1983. They're a one-stop shop offering produce, grocery, bulk, body care, and holistic dispensary. The juice and smoothie bars and kitchens serve up hundreds of healthy dishes and drinks daily. Building community is at the core of their vision, which they deliver through education, outreach, and giving. They want everyone to share in the goodness they offer. Visit their website for more information at thebigcarrot.ca.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Julia Jacobs is the director of the Alberta Children's Epilepsy Program. She's a physician scientist who has been working with children that have epilepsy for more than 15 years. For that program, Dr. Jacobs aims to combine compassionate care for families with providing new treatment options and high-end research to understand mechanisms that lead to seizures. Dr. Jacobs came to Calgary in 2019 to lead the pediatric epilepsy program and is an associate professor at the University of Calgary, an adjunct professor at the University of Freiburg, Germany. Prior to joining the team in Calgary, she's been the interim director of the Department of Pediatric Neurology and Muscular Disease at the University Medical Center Freiburg and the head of the Pediatric Epilepsy Program. Dr. Jacobs has had a close and long-standing relationship to Canada as she received her epilepsy training at the Montreal Neurological Institute at McGill University. Welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
So, for those who don't know, what is epilepsy?
So epilepsy is actually an interesting disease in regard to that it is a summary diagnosis for everyone who has seizures. And that means it's a very frequent diagnosis. There's different numbers out there, but in general, we can say that 1 in 26 people will be affected by seizures and epilepsy in their life. And because it's defined by the symptom, which is seizures, there's actually a big variability. So you can have a very mild epilepsy where you maybe just have one or two seizures in your life and otherwise you have no other problems. And then you can have quite severe forms of epilepsy with a lot of seizures every day and other comorbidities like challenges in mental health, in development, in being able to focus, or of course, safety concerns from your seizures.
When you say seizure, is there sort of a technical meaning to what a seizure is?
So if we talk about a seizure from the brain perspective, it actually means that the brain cells are all of a sudden firing hyperactively, which we mean that they are giving uncoordinated signals. And this is then uncontrollable activity where the patient who has a seizure can actually not do anything about it. So this is from the neuroscience perspective. If we talk about seizures from a perspective of how you see someone having a seizure, then there is actually a very big variation of different seizure types. They can be very mild, from just someone losing contact and staring, towards having like the big convulsions that people maybe know from the movies or have witnessed themselves somewhere in public, which are frightening. You know, the people drop and they are jerking with their body. So this is like, there's a large variation between different seizures.
And that last description, that would be a grand mal seizure?
That's right, yes.
So recently there was International Epilepsy Day. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I actually on March 26, we celebrate something which is originally very Canadian because the person who invented Purple Day is Cassidy, and she is from Canada. And Canada is the only country which actually officially recognized this day as a day of awareness for epilepsy. And it's called Purple Day because everyone is encouraged to show purple colors. Like in different cities around the world, people are lighting up monumental buildings in purple. And it's basically an awareness day for everyone affected by the disease.
How does one get diagnosed with epilepsy? Do you have to have a seizure first that is witnessed, or how do you do that?
So I think this is the case in the majority of people, that they have a seizure which is witnessed. Sometimes they might have had a couple of smaller seizures. People didn't recognize a seizure, and then they have a big seizure, what you called earlier grand mal. And then, of course, it's very obvious that something is wrong. But it's important to know that not everyone who has a seizure also has epilepsy. Epilepsy is actually defined as someone having a seizure without an underlying acute cause. So we call this an unprovoked seizure. If you want to have an example, if you have too much alcohol and you fall and you cause yourself a head injury, and in this context you have one seizure, that doesn't automatically mean that you have epilepsy because your brain got really, really stressed and then you have a seizure as a symptom. We call, like in the epilepsy world, we often say everyone who has a brain can have a seizure if you stress the brain enough. So the difference between having just a seizure and having epilepsy is that if you have epilepsy, you actually have a summary of spontaneous seizures, which are not necessarily provoked by anything, but they just occur randomly and your brain, if you want to say, acts out. So first, that's the most important stepping stone. You have to have at least one to two of these unprovoked seizures to get a diagnosis of epilepsy. And then the other important puzzle piece we often use is a test which is called an EEG or electroencephalogram. And that basically measures electric activity of the brain. And it can give a physician hints and signs that you have a higher likelihood of having these spontaneous seizures than the average population. So sometimes, or most often, it's the combination of these two, witnessing a seizure and doing this EEG test, which leads to a diagnosis of epilepsy.
Is there a genetic component to epilepsy?
Some people have a genetic component, and this can be very different. So some people have really one big change in their genes, and this means that from generation to generation, there can be kids or adults affected by epilepsy. Others have maybe just a genetic predisponency by having multiple genes from their parents coming together and making the brain more vulnerable to seizure. But there are also people who have epilepsy where there is zero genetic component. So this might be, for example, people can develop epilepsy after having a stroke or after having a car accident with head trauma. And then this has nothing to do with genetics. It's just that there is a structural damage in the brain which can cause epilepsy.
Got it. Okay, so I think earlier in the interview you indicated there are different types of seizures. So I guess if you see somebody who's having a seizure, how would you know if it's an epileptic seizure? Are there certain indicia of that?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question because it's not always that easy. Because as I mentioned, there is, depending on which part of the brain acts out, if you want to imagine that, the symptoms of seizures can be very variable. So someone who has seizures from an area which is responsible for hand control, for example, can have a jerking hand, but otherwise be completely responsive and have a conversation. Other people have areas of the brain involved which immediately make them lose contact, and then, you know, you try to chat with them, you touch them, you call out their name, and they're not responding. And then, of course, we have these big seizures where it's often no question that it's a seizure because someone convulsing on the floor is, of course, not a normal symptom. There are even some rare seizure types like seizures where people are involuntarily laughing or crying, and they just can't stop that. So there's a very big variation. I think as a rule of thumb, whenever you have the feeling that someone is losing contact with you or not being able to control what they're doing, like control their movements, even if they can still speak with you, this would be suspicious of a seizure. And then, of course, there are seizures which are, as I said, easy to identify. You know, if someone is losing contact and staring for 3 minutes, I think this would be normal for us to get suspicious that something is wrong.
Right. So let's say you're in a social setting or you're with somebody and it appears that they're having that sort of symptomology, like it appears to you that they might be having a seizure. What as lay people can we do to help?
I think one of the very most important thing is that, and that's why I'm so happy to be chatting with you today, is to be aware that seizures happen and they are actually not a very rare thing to happen. So many people I've been speaking with who have epilepsy are actually mostly worried about people not recognizing they have a seizure. So they are speaking about incidences where they might be in public transport and then they have a seizure where they do, you know, weird things. They are staring, they are chewing, you know, they're making weird hand movements, and people actually think that they are intoxicated or, you know, that they have other psychiatric problems and they are just playing this or whatever. There's a lot of misconception and people have gotten into trouble when they had seizures in public and it wasn't recognized. If we are talking about how can you help someone, so someone who has a big seizure, a convulsion and drops down, the most important thing that you can do is approach the person and stay with the person and make sure that they are physically safe. So if there's sharp edges around, if they are threatened falling down some stairs, you know, if it's close to a train track, whatever, make sure that they are in a safe space. Don't hold onto them tightly or try, you know, there's a misconception. You might want to put something in their mouth so that they don't bite their tongue or swallow their tongue. You don't have to worry about that. Best not to touch their mouth because they're going to bite you, and not to try to force them in a certain position. And then the other thing we encourage is if you have the time and are calm enough to look at your watch and see how long this is lasting, because this is often important if you call help later for people to know, is this person having a seizure for 1 minute or for 10 minutes? And it can be really hard to remember if you're in a stressful situation. And then, of course, if you feel this is like a long thing or the person needs help, call EMS to have some support on the scene. So that they can approach and help whoever is affected by the seizure. I think that's the most important things you can do. If someone is not having a super big convulsion but out of it and confused, just make sure they stay safe. Don't try to constrain them again, but just, you know, talk to them. Try to keep them settled at one space so that they don't run around and hurt themselves.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining that today.
You're very welcome. It was fun chatting with you.
That was Dr. Julia Jacobs. Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, ND, Teacher Terrell, Kristen Rivas, and Dr. Julia Jacobs. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contest prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.